RadioInfluence.com. The future is now.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Welcome in, everybody. This is Thursday, May 30th, and this is the latest edition of the Landry Football Podcast. Appreciate you joining us today, as we appreciate you joining us every Tuesday and Thursday with a different perspective, different look inside the world of football. We cover topics, but we may basically focus on a lot of the insides to give you a deeper look inside the coaching and scouting world of football, from the college to the NFL level, areas of which I'm involved in on a daily basis. So we hope that you are enjoying your trip here. And if you would, just do us one favor to keep this going and to make this successful. Tell a friend about it. And certainly if you're a business and you're interested in us helping your business, contact us. You can reach us at LandryFootball.com. Hit contact Chris, and I'll get you in touch with the right people. We can help promote your business as well here at LandryFootball.com. Got a lot of things prepared for you today. As we normally do, we're going to talk a little bit about a couple of NFL topics. Got a couple of questions to address. We're going to take a little bit most of these podcasts from here on out, we're going to try to take maybe a little different perspective in some little nuggets of things. College football is so broad and with so many teams, we want to take maybe different little looks inside the college game as well as the NFL game of maybe little topics. Like today, I'm going to take a look at not the first-year coaches, but the second-year coaches. Coaches that were first-year coaches at their current school, not necessarily their first-year coaching. But we're going to look at those guys and kind of see where the programs are a year later. We're going to take a look at some of that for you. And, of course, we're going to continue with our X's and O's series. We got a couple of questions along those lines, as well as a couple of other questions that we're going to get to today. And what we're going to talk about and piggyback off of those questions, remember where we left you off on Tuesday. We took you to the middle of the week. We took you to basically the Wednesday practice in the NFL, the Tuesday practice in college football. So we're going to now pick up from Thursday NFL / Wednesday college football, what happens in game plan meetings. We're going to take you through that and take you through that Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or Thursday, Friday, Saturday practices in the NFL. We're going to take you through that today, and then we're going to pick up with the evolving of the game plan as we go into game day. So we're going to take it in segments, kind of if you have not listened to the past few podcasts, go back and listen to it. It's like a classroom setting to where if you kind of just pick things up from here on out, some of it will make sense. Some of it is built off of what we talked about the last two or three podcasts. So it's if you look at it as a lecture series, we kind of give you a perspective of how a game plan evolves from the end of the last game to the beginning of the next. So now we're kind of at that next stage. So go back and listen to it, if you will. Going to start with a couple of things that are on the agenda. Someone had mentioned and asked, so I wanted to get into this right off the top, about really what happens on a free agent visit. Free agent period is slowed down a little bit. When we had the first stage of free agency, we're focusing a lot on, you know, who's going here or there, and we keep you up to date on everything at LandryFootball.com. By the way, got our scouting season sale. You'll want to take advantage of that right now to get inside the college, get inside the NFL game as we're breaking down the rosters. But in our daily notebooks, we'll keep you up to date on what's going on around the NFL, around college football, the news, the notes, the insights from talking to coaches. And when it's the first wave of free agency, we focus a lot on where a guy's visiting, where he may sign, and all that. Now that free agency slowed down, but there's still some interesting visits. Like, for example, right now, the biggest one around the league is Gerald McCoy and his visits and where his status is. I thought it would be time, a good time, to kind of answer a question. What really goes on those quote-unquote recruiting visits for an NFL free agent? It's similar in some ways as a college football recruit, but there's a different element to it. Obviously, as a pro player, you're dealing with a contract, dealing with an agent, dealing with money. So typically how this will work is a player will fly in from wherever he currently resides, or maybe he's coming from another city where he's visited another team. Normally what you see a player do is he'll go on a visit, depending upon his schedule and the calendar, he'll go from one team to the next to visit. Sometimes there's a gap in between because of personal issues, both ways, not being able to meet each other's schedules. But normally that's how the process works. So here's what will typically happen. A player will come in, and if it's a high-profile player that you're really trying to woo, you'll probably have the position coach or coordinator meet him at the airport to make an impression. Let's just call it like it is. If it's a young man that is trying to make a team, you're giving a tryout to, you know, he's looking for an opportunity, you haven't even decided that you wanted him yet, that guy is probably going to be picked up by an intern in the scouting department. And, you know, somebody that's personable and get them where they need to go. But, you know, you don't get the royal treatment. What you'll see is somebody pick them up that's a little bit more high profile, somebody that they've talked with over the phone. It's a great opportunity to meet, talk with them. Depending upon when the player's arriving, usually the first thing they'll do is go out for a meal. So if they're arriving late afternoon, early evening, obviously they go to dinner. If it's in the morning, maybe they'll go to lunch. If it's kind of in between, maybe they'll go back to the facilities. Then they'll have lunch or dinner. Or, you know, I've had situations where a guy comes in and it's pretty early, maybe mid-morning. Maybe you have a breakfast or a brunch. You kind of play that by ear, but you have it planned that you want to have a place lined up where you can have a nice meal. And if you do that, have somebody join them. So let's say you're bringing in a Gerald McCoy. Defensive line coach may pick him up. Coordinator may be with him, or maybe the coordinator will join them for the lunch, breakfast, brunch, dinner, whatever the meal may be. Maybe the head coach may join. But normally it's be the position coach and the coordinator. You sit there. Maybe it's personnel director. You have a couple of people there. And you want to make it casual. You ideally like to have maybe some one-on-one time with a position coach, or maybe, you know, with the position coach and a coordinator to really show the guy some love and really get to know the guy. Talk a little bit about their family and what's going on there and how many kids and what do your wife think about this or that, or where is she from? What part of the country have y'all lived in, she lives in, so on and so forth. How old are the kids? Yada, yada, yada. And this is a way to kind of throw out some generic things about that will be important to the player that, you know, you may not think is really important because you're not thinking of these people as people. But, you know, the schools are really good in this area, or, you know, the housing situation or whatever. You get some general conversation that goes on. Again, depending upon what time of day it is, what meal, what have you. At some point, you're obviously going to go to a facility. Depending on the situation, you normally will have a physical set up. So the player will go take a physical, make sure that checks out. When you're at the facility, the player is going to meet with the head coach. He's going to meet with the general manager. He's going to tour the facilities. There is usually a player on your team that may know this player. You do your research. You'll have them meet you. Maybe they'll meet you for lunch or brunch or what have you. It's all picked up by the team, of course. And if that's not the case, then certainly the player you hope is in town and maybe can meet them. If they're not in town, you'll see if there's any way the player can be in town. You plan it so that the player that's on your roster that knows this current free agent will spend some time at least at the facility. That's really good to have them speak on behalf of the organization and how it's from a player's perspective, how good it is, so on and so forth. There's a recruiting element that comes from the personal side that affects their family. That's very, very important. Then there's going to be some time where the coordinator will spend with the player, usually with the position coach, maybe a couple of other coaches on that side of the ball, that there'll be a film room session. There'll be a cut-up tape that's made of him as a player. Here's what we like about you. Here's, 10, 20, 30 plays that it really jumped out that's a good fit. And let me tell you why we like this about you and how it's going to factor into what we like to do. So let's use the case of Gerald McCoy. You see what he does in terms of pass rush and run defense, his alignment. Then you combine that with cut-ups of what you do. And let me explain what we do. And here's how we see you fitting in. Here's where we can feature you. Here's what we've got. Here's what we've got on our D-line. Here's what we've got coming back. Here's what we'd like to do. Okay, but you notice we do more of this because we haven't had somebody like you. This is where we see you fitting. This is where we're headed. Here's where your role is going to be. Here's how you're going to be featured. Here's how you're going to be, what we hope it can be. And it could be a player that maybe is somewhat of a declining player, but here's how we can really rejuvenate your career. Or here, if it's a player that hadn't quite hit his peak, here's how we can jumpstart you and get you to that next level. You've got to know the player. You've got to know where he's coming from and where you are willing to take him and how you're the path that you're going to take him on. And you show that to him with tape. And you don't spend a lot of time, but you spend enough time to really capitalize how it's going to be a fit. Then he'll spend time with the head coach. He'll talk about some big overall picture. He'll talk about how he fits in the locker room, what we're looking for, how things are done here. Here's how we handle things here. And then from a general manager standpoint, he'll sit there and talk as well. Usually the last visit, we'll sit there and talk to the player and get a feel for, all right, this is, where are you? What are you thinking? What you're looking at right now? And what are some of your other options that you're considering? What are you looking for? What can we answer for you? You always want to make sure that. If a player is really interested, you have available some people that are in the real estate business that may want to take them on a half an hour, 45-minute ride about some places that are in the area. You have that at the ready so that someone is able to do that. You have some questions about some off-the-field stuff. That's available there. Equipment men are alerted. The training staff's alerted. Everybody's alerted as to who's coming and, kind of how we're trying to make a nice impression. And you want to see, people that are putting on their best foot forward and making it seem like a very home field atmosphere. If a player is interested enough, you try to feel him out and say, look, we'd like to sit there and talk with your agent about seeing about getting a deal. Is that something that you're comfortable with at this point? And then, of course, you move forward with meeting with the agent. The agent may be there. You may be doing business with the agent by phone. You get on the phone with them. You have an idea what you want. You're not talking money with the player. Player doesn't want to talk money. He's got his agent to do that. The team doesn't want to talk money with the player because – you never want to get into that because you don't ever want to insult anybody or give an opinion one way or the other. The agent is there to kind of to be the buffer so that you can talk to the agent about the value of the player and basically can say, unless we like him, but here's where we like him, and we're not prepared to go more than that. And then that way the agent doesn't have to – if you have some conversations along the lines, well, we think he should get this, what this guy gets, and you can say to the agent, your guy is not as good as that guy. You don't want to really tell that to a player to his face. That can be somewhat disrespectful and a turnoff, but you can certainly share that with an agent, and a good agent's going to take that information, may not agree with it or like it, but is going to kind of protect you from saying, hey, look, tell the player, just couldn't get it done. We couldn't get them any more than this. So let's just, here's where we are, and here's where we're going to go with it. But ideally, if you like a guy, you have a game plan in mind, which you're going to offer. And quite frankly, you try to get a deal done before he leaves. And you are aware of the flexibility of how much higher you're willing to go off of your main offer and what's your stopping point. It's the job of the agent and the player to get multiple teams interested to get them bidding against one another. That's pivotal. And from there, sometimes you get a deal done. When you don't, and a player is going to go back home or go on another visit, you obviously, hey, we'll keep in touch. We'll talk with your guy. Keep us in mind. Hey, look, don't do anything until you check with us again. And, you know, and you try to leave it on really good terms. And then you bring them back to the airport and take good care of them along the way. Make sure he's off and safe and sound and off to his next stop. That's pretty much a visit for you. Now, something that's been asked that I think is important. People have always asked, what about the need for an agent? Is there really a need for an agent? In this day and age, for your first contract, a player that's drafted or an undrafted free agent, the money's slotted. So all you need is a lawyer to look over the contract and the legal language, which is standard. And you really could save a lot of money by not using an agent early. I mean, there's no need for it. There's no negotiation. Now, on your second contract, for kind of the reasons that I mentioned, second contracts are beyond. The need for an agent, I think, is important. You can't allow a player to be distracted by trying to negotiate. It's not a great situation. Even if they're capable, you don't want the distraction of having to negotiate. Then it gets personal where you're having to discuss things that you can start to have conversations that can become a little bit uncomfortable and kind of rub each other the wrong way. It's also a situation where a quality agent can survey the landscape and get you into the right situations and probably negotiate you a better deal than you can. In the most cases, that's what you can do on your second contract. You're a rookie, you sign your first deal, maybe you're 2 years into it, maybe there's some initial talk about getting a long-term deal done. Well, that's where you really want to have an agent that can kind of protect you, that's going to know the contract language, going to know the financial figures a little bit more than you just researching it. So it's not essential to have one on your first contract. I think beyond that, it is really imperative that you have one. Okay, going to get to a couple of things here, a couple of questions that have been asked. Kevin asked, there are media reports of the NFLPA warning agents to tell their players to prepare for a possible 2021 work stoppage. That is correct. Can you please discuss what you foresee as being the main sticking points? Well, the sticking points are not as easily defined, but revolve around percentage of revenue, how players are treated from the post-contract medical benefits and things of that nature. But a lot of it revolves around money and percentage of the money, percentage of the total revenue. And there are a lot of other minor things, but it really comes to that. The reason why agents are telling players to prepare for their money is because the work stoppage is going to affect them a lot more than it's going to affect the teams. Owners are wealthy. Players are rich. Big difference. Kevin also asked, what are the minimum personnel requirements for a team to have sustained success using the 46 defense in the NFL? Well, you're not going to have any – no one runs the 46 defense. 46 defense – the 46 is not a defense. The 46 is a front, and it is a front that is used sparingly in the NFL, but nobody runs a 46 defense. That doesn't exist. Even – when the Bears ran it, it was, again, a 46 front. It's like a Tampa 2 defense. Well, Tampa 2 is not a defense. It's a coverage. So the 46 is a defensive front in which you have both the center and both guards uncovered. You have to have guys that are strong, that are quick, that can push the pocket from the middle, and you have to have big physical corners that can hold up in man coverage. Because in a 46 defense, you put defensive front, you put the safety in the box. But so you've got a single high or sometimes a free safety cheating up, and the ball's going to come out quicker. But you've got to get pressure up the middle, and you've got to get that safety free at the line of scrimmage to be able to bring some extra pressure from different launch points, usually from the B or C gap. But it can be from the D gap on the outside. But that's really the key. So the key is to run a 46 front. When you do run it, you've got to have impact guys in the interior, defensive tackle. You've got to have defensive ends that win one-on-one, and you've got to have a safety that can play very well in the box and be like a linebacker against the run and in pressure. So, anyway, I think that that obviously how the linebackers play are important, but those are some key things. But remember, there is no such thing as a 46 defense. It's a 46 front, which everybody on occasion uses it, some more than others. But we're not talking about anybody running that style of a defense or that even that style of a front for an extended period of time. It just doesn't happen because there's just more variances in how you run it. And the answer to the 46 front was the quick pass game, which kind of negated that pressure. The ball came out quicker before the rush could get there. But it was very effective, and most notably with the Bears of Buddy Ryan. Rock asked about, I'm one of the few people in Wisconsin not all thrilled about Hornibrook's departure. This is Alex Hornibrook. It was at the University of Wisconsin. He piloted the winningest season in Wisconsin history and was driving for a playoff berth in the title game against Ohio State. Even with his struggles and multiple concussions last year, he was far away the best Wisconsin quarterback. Cone was out of his element against a good Miami team, laid down and died. Okay, Mertz was a star in Kansas High School football, and he was a raw freshman in the Big Ten. Chris, what do you think about all of this? I think there's some valid points. I think Hornibrook was definitely a leader. I think in this offense, being able to manage a game and understand where to go with the football at the right time is imperative. It is even more imperative for a team that's not going to get a lot of big plays. So it is certainly more reliant on making the prudent play time and time again. A freshman quarterback doesn't necessarily lend itself to that. I would agree with you that Cone really struggled. I think with more experience, Cone could be better. I do think the future is Mertz. The future may be sooner than later, and he could bring more big play element to it. But the key in their offense is not the plays that they make, but the plays you don't make. And I do think that it could be a factor this year in how they play. You ask if Chris told Hornibrook to leave or did he leave on his own. I don't know anything. And you talk about maybe a confrontation of the locker room. There's rumors to that. I don't know to what of that is true. I do know that the staff, including Paul, had talks with Alex. I think it was more Alex wanting to leave. But I think it was something that they discussed that they thought, he thought it was better to move on. And I don't know. I don't know the personal details about a girlfriend or an issue that could have had in the locker room. I'm not sure about that. And I wouldn't want to speculate on that. All right. Thanks. Those are some great insightful questions. Appreciate that. A couple of things wanted to jump into real quick about some new coaches that are in the NFL, in college football rather, that I think are going to be fun to watch in their second year. A couple of them that jump out at me, Dan Mullen. The thing that jumped out at me is how much better prepared they were coaching-wise from an offensive standpoint. They were six in total offense in the SEC. And it's the first time they've been in the top 10 since 2009. They've been poorly prepared on offense. You saw the improvement there. And I think that the recruiting is going well, and I think Dan's an ideal fit there. I felt it from the beginning. Jimbo Fisher, that sounds like and feels like a great fit. Recruiting, I thought they were so much better prepared on the field than under Kevin Sumlin. I think it's going to be a big-time hit there. Scott Frost at Nebraska, I thought they got better as the year went along. They lost four games with more than 20 points at an average scoring margin of minus 10 and a half. Last fall, that was in 2017. Last fall, they lost only one game by 20-plus points. So they hung in games. They competed. There's every reason to believe they should be a factor in the Big Ten West going forward. Are they ready yet? Well, listen, I think that the West is wide open. We just talked about Wisconsin, Iowa. Nebraska should be right there with them. Absolutely should be. And there's no doubt in my mind that should be the case. A guy that did a nice job last year in his first year was Herm Edwards. They did win one fewer Pac-12 game, but they were improved. Curious to see how sustainable this is. But I thought he did a nice job. Also in the Pac-12, I thought Mario Cristobal did a nice job. More impressed with what he's doing off the field and recruiting. But definitely, he's got that program headed in the right direction. And I'm excited to see what he can do on the field, because that's going to be the key, is game day management, working the team, getting the team to play up to its potential week in and week out. That's an unknown. Going back to the SEC, Tennessee and Jeremy Pruitt. They won two SEC games against two teams that won a combined 18 games. They beat Kentucky and Auburn, but they lost six games by 25 points or more, including the final two to Missouri and Vanderbilt by a combined score of 88-30. The inconsistency factor is a byproduct of the talent gap and the talent inconsistencies. They're going to play a lot of young guys this year. They're going to make some mistakes. I think Jeremy is improving the program. He's improving the culture and doing good things. But they're not going to compete with Florida or Georgia anytime soon. And I don't expect them to catch Georgia or Florida as long as Georgia and Florida are doing it the way they're doing it. Those programs would have to come back to Tennessee. But at least if Tennessee can get to the point where they can beat every year Vanderbilt, Kentucky, Missouri, South Carolina, they got to win all of those games. They got to go 4-0 against those teams every year. And then if you play a BYU and a UAB, you've got to get your fifth and sixth wins there. And then depending upon your rest of your schedule, you've got to be competitive. But I don't expect them within the next 5 years to jump ahead of Florida or Georgia. Could they beat Florida or Georgia or Alabama in a given year in a you know, one-game setting? Yes. But can they beat them? Can they have a better program? Can they be on par with them? No, I don't think they will be. I think, again, those programs would have to come back a little bit for Tennessee to be able to catch them. I'm a little bit concerned, quite frankly, about Joe Moorhead at Mississippi State. I thought the team regressed a little bit. Now, they were talented, but it was a tough situation. Dan Mullen did a great job at Mississippi State. Moorhead did a really good job offensively in all of his stops. I thought there was a transition issue and a problem on offense that led to some issues. I mean, they were 4-4 and 9-4, 4-4 in the league and 9-4 overall. 8-5 and 4-4. It's a bit of a rebuilding year. You wonder if he's going to be able to keep the program at the same level of Dan Mullen. If he doesn't, it'll not be considered a success there. Chip Kelly, you know, you look at it in a big picture, you say, look, 3-9, 3-6. Chip's going to do it his way. It's no quick fix. The offense was bad. They were among the worst offensive team. But one thing I can tell you is that they look better on tape as the year went along. They'll get better. But Chip is a tear it down and build it my own image guy. So I think it'll be better than last year. I don't know if they're going to go to a bowl game, but I think he'll get it turned around to where they'll be competitive again. I don't know if they're going to compete and win the Pac-12, but this is not – Chip is not a come in and tinker with it. He's coming in with a bulldozer and building it from scratch. So it will take a little time. I'm very curious to see what goes on in Oxford this year with Ole Miss and Matt Luke. Defense allowed 41 points a game in SEC play. They're going to have new coordinators. McIntyre's coming in to run the defense. Rich Rodriguez coming in to run the offense. Both former head coaches in the Pac-12. Both of those guys would like to be the head coach at Ole Miss, head coach somewhere. I don't know how that's going to work out. Honestly, don't. That's a program that I'm a little bit concerned about right now. I like what Chad Morris is doing in recruiting. They won only two games overall. That's the fewest since 1952. It's a rebuild. They went winless in the SEC for the second time since joining the league in 1992. They were outscored 90-6 in the final 2 weeks in their losses to Mississippi State and Missouri. It is a big-time rebuild. And no, Chad is not going to get Arkansas competing in the top of the West. He's not. Their competition is going to be against the two Mississippi schools to see who can stay out of the basement of the West this year and probably for the next foreseeable few years. Arkansas is, I think, potentially a better program than two Mississippi schools, but they're looking up at LSU. They're looking up at A&M. They're looking up at Auburn. They're looking up at Alabama. And they always will, unless those programs regress and come back to Arkansas. So the thought that give Chad a couple of years and he's going to be competing for the West, that's not happening. I think Chad will do a good job, but a good job there is going to bowl games. Maybe every third or fourth year, once it's rolling, maybe you can get to 9 wins, have a really good year. Don't see it in the current state of the SEC being reasonable that they can compete. Now, Auburn is a program that's up and down, so you could see Auburn having a bad year and them finishing ahead of Auburn in a given year until they figure out either Gus develops some consistency or somebody else comes in. We're going to have to see. So those are some guys that Kevin Sumlin needs to have a bounce-back year at Arizona. Khalil Tate's going to be a big part of it if he can stay healthy. No one's on a bigger hot seat going into their second year than Willie Taggart at Florida State. It was the worst-looking coach team in America last year. They lost a staggering 6 games by 19 or more points. That's not the byproduct of a program in shambles left over by Jimbo Fisher. That is the byproduct of a complete collapse and a complete lack of direction. Jimbo is culpable to a degree. But if you're looking at 100% blame, this is a 75% on Willie Taggart, 25% at most on Jimbo. So those are a look at some of the guys heading into their second year. All right, let's move on and talk a little bit. Got a couple of questions to address that was asked about our X's and O's series. Who's responsible, Chris, more for the overall game plan, the head coach or the coordinators? Well, it depends upon the situation. In college, in the NFL, the head coach comes through the ranks. You're not born a baby coach, right? So you come through the ranks either on one side of the ball or the other. So you usually come as a coordinator, and some guys are better coordinators than others. Some guys are more – you got the Ed Orgeron types. It was never really a coordinator per se, but more recruiter. You have some of those guys. But most of the guys come from a coordinator ranks. Bill Belichick, defensive coordinator. Pete Carroll, defensive coordinator. Sean Payton, offensive coordinator in the NFL. Nick Saban, defensive coordinator. Dabo Sweeney, never been a coordinator. Different type of coach. Kirby Smart, defensive coordinator. Go on and on with different coaches that come from different sides of the ball. So depending on the situation, many times coaches will build the game plan on the side of the ball that they coach. If they are the coordinator themselves, Sean Payton, for example, in the NFL, he is involved in the game planning that week with Drew Brees and the offensive coaches. He calls the plays. In other cases, the designated head coach will have a coordinator that will run the coordinator meetings, establish a game plan with everything exposed to the head coach for his approval, and the coordinators will call that side of the ball. There's some head coaches, again, who call the plays. There's some that don't call the plays. There's some, like Jimbo Fisher, that will have help coordinating the meetings during the week, but will ultimately call the plays. Sometimes coaches will give up play-calling responsibilities to oversee things a little bit more, and sometimes they take it back. We see that with Gus Malzahn at Auburn. He's given it up, the play calling. He's taking it back. And so it really depends. But normally you have a head coach that was really good at calling plays. He got to be a head coach for one reason or another. Some cases it's recruiting. Some cases it's leadership. Some cases it's really dynamic play caller on one side of the ball or the other. So if a coach really wants to have that role of being the play caller as an offensive or defensive coordinator, do it. You just got to make sure that some of the head coach responsibilities are divvied up within the staff to allow you the extra time to prepare for the meetings and prepare for the extra time that it takes to be the play caller. Other question that Ed was, what is the primary responsibility of a position coach? Well, first of all, the coordinators are going to install the game plan in teams meeting, and it becomes the position coach's job to teach his position group the plan for that week. In addition to teaching the game plan, the position coaches during the game day make sideline adjustments during the game. So let's just say that a D coordinator wants to send linebacker on a blitz. The position coach for that linebacker might chime in that while it's a good call that the linebacker that you're asking it of missed two blitz calls the previous week and didn't do a very good job in practice this week. Therefore, let's not run it with him. It's important to be able to have that input. And then, of course, it's important that the position coach be experts in establishing what the position critical factors are for the draft or recruiting. So the linebacker coach has to have an understanding of what the team wants to do schematically and what you're looking for in every different role. The linebacker coach has to know exactly what they're looking for their linebackers playing against the run, against the pass, against the inside run, against the perimeter run. All those things are important. So that's the role of the position coach. And of course, recruiting is a big factor for college guys at any position. I think they ought to have a real input in the position that they coach, who you're recruiting, but obviously they've got an area to recruit that's really important as well in their job description. All right, I'm going to get into the mid to latter part of the week part of the game plan. So this is going to be Thursday in the NFL and Wednesday in college football. Picking up where we left off on Tuesday's podcast. By early in the morning, 8:30, 9 o'clock at the latest, players are in meetings. They'll look at the previous day's practice with their position coaches. They'll watch film from the previous day's practice, make corrections first in the classroom, then walk through any changes or fixes on the field. They'll literally get out there and kind of walk through it. Okay, then on Wednesday, college football, Thursday in the NFL, it's time to move on at third down day. By the time you break for lunch on that day, players will have practiced the plays. They're likely to make up 90% of their game plan, okay? For college guys that practice in the afternoon, by the time they've done, they will wake up. For the coaches, the post-practice routine is the same as the day before. They watch film from practice and assess everything they've done. You ask yourself as a staff, what problems are we encountering in practice? What are we having trouble with assignment-wise? Have we given ourselves enough options on third down, or do we need to add some plays to the mix? This is defending third downs for the defense and executing third downs for the offense. This is what you focus on. Now, this is where you tend to add or subtract based upon how the practice is progressing during the week. Then, of course, it's time to prepare and install the packages that's going to be practiced on Friday, or in the case of college football on Thursday. Okay, so Friday NFL, Thursday college football is goal line and short yardage situation and two-minute offense. Okay, so you've adjusted what you're going to do off the third down package. Then you install your goal line, short yardage, and two-minute offense as a staff. Then you get together on Thursday with your players. College football, Friday in the NFL, and the day begins the same day, same time as the previous day's practice, and you incorporate the changes and corrections from a third down package first. Then you install the specialization package, goal line, short yardage, 2 minute. And you walk through that on the field. You install it in the classroom, walk through it on the field. Now, players aren't in pads on Fridays in the NFL. Thursday, we'll have a nice little practice in pads, the college guys. What's being installed on Friday, and that varies a little bit. Some guys taper off. Some guys like a hard padded practice on Thursday. Now, what's being installed on Friday in the NFL or Thursday in college? He's going to have some overlap with plays that are practiced on third down Thursday, but these might be run with no huddle, okay? Coaches will have a package of six or seven plays for the two-minute drill. Even if the quarterback's a young guy and experienced and new to the team, you got to run it. You got to run the two-minute drill. Those plays are likely offshoots of the audible package, and the plays kept in the mix will feature a heavy dose of passes. I think that the two-minute drill is really important in today's game. Probably needs to be practiced a little bit longer, even the early part of the week. But be that as it may, it's still a predominantly Thursday, college football, Friday, NFL practice period. Where the team is on offense or defense, the last 2 minutes of both halves tend to be the most critical points of the game. And so you've got to, I think, put some extra emphasis on it. Running out of practice time is something that we always struggle with coaches. There's no question about that. So you move on. Teams have only 14 padded practices over the entirety of the regular season in the NFL. And you have a 20-hour work week in college. You don't have the time required to convert, you know, a quarterback coming from a college bred offense to a pocket passer or do something like that drastic. You can't do that. You don't have enough time to do that. So that's why you got to spend time installing and practicing over the summer in the offseason, the spring, to get things ready. So there are things that are put in during the summer that might not get in practice for the entire season. Once something is installed, the players are responsible for it. Okay, you might put in 10 gadget plays over the summer. Then when you got to break out that option pass for the halfback in the week nine, you better have it down cold, because you haven't practiced it doesn't mean you're not responsible for knowing how to do it. You just have to pull out a tape, maybe look at it, walk through it in a hotel or in a meeting room, or, you know, but you've got to get it prepared for. Players also in this day and age with their iPads are given cut-ups to look at. That's going to help them prepare for their responsibilities, as well as, you know, maybe a look at some of these plays that you don't physically go through, but you got to be prepared for. All right, now we're on to Saturday in the NFL or Friday in college football. So in essence, it's the day before the game. Usually get going a little bit earlier, about an hour earlier. You review the previous day's practice and you walk through corrections. So you've gone through all those scenarios of the practice before, the gadget plays, the 2 minute short yardage goal line. You walk through all the corrections. Then you may put in, I always like to have time to put in one special play that you walk through to make sure you got. It's not a physically intense practice. It's about 45 minutes to an hour and is really focused on walkthrough. It's usually sometimes in sweats or shorts. And you usually try to spend that time going through corrections and just rehearsing and not being on their feet a lot. Now, if you are a team that is playing at home, you will report to the hotel a little later for a home game, even so that's what they do. And if you're going on the road, you're leaving out on Friday in college or in the NFL on Saturday. The exception might be leaving a day early if you're going from one side of the country to the other, like Miami to Seattle, for example. And you meet again that night, Saturday night or Friday night. It's one of the last opportunities that the coach will hammer out some things and reminders. Maybe it's something inspirational. Maybe it's just something focusing on the two or three things that you've got to do to win the game. And then it'll be handed over to special teams, and we'll focus on making sure that you look a little film, make sure that your assignment's sound in every situation. One of the things that's always really important at this time, you got the entire team in the room. So what you'll do, the special teams coach will do something like, all right, punt coverage team up. And everybody that's a starter's got to stand up. You better know your responsibility. Okay, and then you got to say, you have one guy sit down. You call him out. The L4 sit down on kick return. Boom. Who's up? The guy that's his backup better stand up and know he's the backup. If he's not, that's where you have problems. You ever see where you got to call timeout, wrong guys on the field? It's because somebody's been injured and somebody's not prepared to go in the game. He wasn't aware somebody was injured. It is the responsibility of an assistant to make sure that the next guy's ready to go in. And if you don't, you're going to be wasting a timeout. So you practice that in a meeting room where everyone's there. And you've got the pressure of knowing what you're supposed to do, or you're going to be embarrassed in front of everybody. Better than costing your team a timeout. So you try to do that. So that is something that's really reliable. Then after this special teams meeting, the offense and defense will break into their separate rooms. They'll watch some form of video. It could be something like the 10 best plays we've run this year, things that didn't go well that cost us the game last week that we need to do better. It depends upon how you feel about your team. If you feel like your team is struggling and they're lacking in confidence, you got to show them maybe the 10 best plays. We need to ignore this. And this is how we made this play, and this is what we need to do going forward to make this happen. If you feel like your guys are confident but maybe overconfident and they seem to feel like they have all the answers, you may show some things that may kind of humble them a little bit. Those things are really important. It's a chance to review, kind of make things, you know, clear in terms of responsibilities. And then you go from there. And you get there, and that is, you're off the snack and off to bed. And when we pick this up on Tuesday, we're going to talk about what happens on game day and what happens from the time you wake up to the course of the game. So that'll keep you up to date on what we're doing and how we're doing it, and we will pick it up there. Hope this gives you a real understanding of what goes on step by step through a game plan week. So we appreciate you, and we hope that you have a great rest of the week and weekend. Remember to keep it at LandryFootball.com for all the latest college football and NFL information as we keep you up to date all year long, breaking down the rosters, studying film, keeping you up to date on recruiting, what's going on, OTAs in the NFL, you name it. We've got it covered on college football and the NFL right here at LandryFootball.com. Join us there, and we'll join you next Tuesday in another edition of the Landry Football Podcast on LandryFootball.com.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
This is a crush performance with Jeff Crichel Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
You can agree with me or disagree. The way our system is set up, we're not developing the best talent. We haven't created an environment long-term that allows these kids to really, really harness their potential. And again, it's not, the objective is not to build high-performance athletes. It's if we create a really good system, there'll just be more kids getting opportunities if they want to go that route. And for the ones that don't, well, listen, they're going to have more fun. They're going to get better at their sport, and maybe they'll just play recreational for life. All these things come into play. So again, Doug, getting back to it, sorry, crush sidebar over. But Doug, getting back to it, that's how we set up our programs. We look at the entire schedule the athlete has, and then we determine what kind of work, the volume and the intensity of work that's going to best support their health and their ability to play the game. Then nutrition, hydration backs that right up. And then we look at posture, because listen, if their posture is off, they're at higher risk of injury, period. That's how it works. So there's lots of things you guys can do in your warmups or in a small training period a couple times a week at the end of your practices to help your athletes correct their posture, arrange of motion around critical joints, and even working on their core. Great stuff. And that's just general health stuff, but also great for sport performance. And then movement. This is where we really start getting into the sport specific stuff. After those are established, the mental game for those athletes who need it. Some do, some don't, some need it more, some don't. Visual training. Everybody can be doing that. It's very simple. You do have to know what you're doing. Don't get me wrong. It's not that simple, but it's an important part of sport performance, especially for those athletes that need it. And then you can start branching off into individual programs, but also then start really, really tapping into the skill development. Skill development is sort of a last priority when it comes to athlete development.
Crush Performance with Jeff Crichel can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.